Welcome to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here. And we're very fortunate today to have as our guest Dr. John Huber, who is an expert, among other things, on technology addiction. Welcome, John, to our show.
Thank you, Dr. Mike, for having me. I appreciate it.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am at this currently a clinical forensic psychologist. I started my career in the early 90s as a school psychologist. And academically, you know, we're doing clinical psychology, but we always end up in the courts. So I kind of drifted over into the legal side of it, went back and got more degrees and became trained as a forensic psychologist. And along the way, I taught at Texas State University over a period of about 21 years. And I have a small practice and privileges at two medical hospitals, and I see patients in a ketamine clinic. We do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, as well as forensically with a group of attorneys throughout the state of Texas and a couple other states that I occasionally go and provide services for.
Wow, what a great background. And you have some interest in expertise in addictions, is that true?
Yes, actually, you know, I was one of those frustrated therapists because addiction is such a difficult thing to work with. And I found originally I was working harder than my patients were in a lot of cases because they were driven by, you know, a family member or somebody who loved them and they loved, or a court system, and they really weren't invested in quitting, because that kind of seems to be the key thing. And what we've been doing with the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is we've kind of found out the ketamine doesn't care if my patient wants to quit or not, and we've been running about 75-80% effective rates for stopping, you know, cessation of different addictions, alcohol, heroin, and like that.
That's incredible. Can you tell us, I know that our show is not technology addiction, but I'm very interested if you wouldn't mind telling the audience about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy for addiction. How does that work?
Well, the interesting thing with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is we're not using it for sedation. And in fact, we tend to call it a shamanic experience. So there is some distortion of your perception of reality while you're on the ketamine. And we monitor you in your biofeedback, your heart rate, blood pressure, and a few other markers, and we watch that. And physiologically, we can tell for most patients when they drop their ego defense mechanism. And once they do that, they're kind of primed then for the psychotherapy. And the wonderful thing with that is some people, you know, they're good for 45 minutes to an hour, but some of the people, those defense mechanisms are gone or not being utilized by them for up to 3 hours. So we can have some really long-term intense therapy. And the amazing thing is the amnesic properties of the ketamine. The next day, they remember us talking, but they can't remember what we talked about. So we're kind of getting into their subconscious a little bit like that. And we do it, you know, everybody is different. We kind of monitor different key markers. And right now, you know, I don't necessarily like to share everybody what those markers are, because it's taken us several years to figure those out. And we've gotten pretty good at it, and our staff monitoring those things. And they come back to us, the patients do, weeks later, saying, oh, you know, this is going on. And almost like hypnotherapy, you know, when you plant a suggestion in somebody, they come back to us, and they're like, oh, man, I was sitting there, and my buddies came over, and they were wanting me to use. And I heard this voice in my head saying, hey, you know, you got to take care of your kids in the morning, and this is going to, you know, stop me from doing that. And I turned them down, and I walked away from that stuff. And those are some of the messages we were implanting because, you know, we built a therapeutic relationship with this patient. We found out what the triggers were, and we use that to identify and individualize the therapy for each individual person. And we're being very successful with it at this time.
This is remarkable. And while they're under the ketamine, what does the therapy consist of? Do you talk about motivational factors, pros and cons? What do you do during the therapy?
It depends a lot on the patient themselves. You know, some people some patients are truly using it just pure escapism, and that's going to be different than if we use it. They're actually thinking they're managing the situation by using the alcohol or the heroin or cocaine or whatever. So it's individualized, definitely. But we use both those models.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Fascinating work. It's a little bit like the psilocybin research that's going on right now with addiction as well.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you must be following that as well, huh?
Yes, and we use a lot of the same modalities that they're talking about in that. The main researcher that we've been following is out of Russia, actually, and because he's one of the few people who's actually used the ketamine and documented it with things like heroin and cocaine. And the problem is all his writing is in Russian, so we've been lucky enough to be able to actually get him on the phone and talk with him some. And unfortunately, the Russian government has shut down the research because it doesn't fit in with the new economy they're trying to make, and they're trying to make the drug companies profitable, and you know, they'd rather maintain as opposed to fix problems. So they kind of shut him down as far as his new research.
Yeah. And are you using the ketamine IV or are you intranasally?
We have some problems with the intranasal stuff. We are using an IV push. It's not a bolus. We're not sedating the patient. It is an IV push, and we're driven by medical doctors, that side of it. I'm a PhD, so I don't administer that myself directly. We have an EMT and nurse practitioner on staff as well that are monitoring, and then I'm in the room with my patients while they're getting the infusion, and then following up with that, either myself or the other therapist out of my office.
Absolutely fascinating. And is the treatment, how many sessions and at what frequency?
Generally, it depends, but generally 4 to 6 sessions within a 30-day period, depending upon the substance use and the level of physiological addiction, because we can actually use the ketamine to help detox. If we're in a situation where we have to do that first, and then that's a total different treatment set of standards and protocols, and then once they're detoxed, then we move into the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy.
And then do you have sort of integrative sessions in between the ketamine sessions as well?
Yes, but sometimes depending upon the client's needs, we may be doing a session every day, or a ketamine infusion every day, so we may not have time between them. And we typically do this, in an inpatient setting. We have our own sober house, and we keep them there. Because their defense mechanisms are down, we don't allow them access to news sources because we don't want them being upset and internalizing some of that agitation and stuff. So we don't have television in our sober house.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to sort of limit their stimulation during that
truly
time of integration. Absolutely fascinating, Dr. Huber. It's really interesting to hear that you're doing that work. Very, very interesting. Anything published on this at all with the ketamine?
We're collecting data right now, and we have a preliminary acceptance on a case study with actually using an emergency medical technician and helping him deal with his PTSD using the same model, except for PTSD as opposed to the alcoholism at this point.
Yeah, this is a quantum change in psychopharmacology, isn't it?
Absolutely, and we've gotten so much pushback. And our patients are like, no, please don't stop, because, like I said, we're having 75 to 80% effectiveness rate.
Yeah, it's really incredible. About twice the efficacy of even our best evidence-based treatments for addiction. Really incredible.
Yes. Last year we had, for alcohol alone, we went through about 14 patients, and we've had one of them relapse out of 14.
Oh, my gosh. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, God bless you for the work that you're doing, pioneering work, very, very exciting. Well, tell us about a little bit, what is technology addiction anyway?
Well, technology addiction is kind of a fascinating thing, and it's kind of hard to look at it as a true addiction until we started looking at the research And what we find out are that these game programmers and app programmers are amazing behavioralists. And whether they knew they were doing this or not, the games, for example, and the social media apps, whether it's, you know, Facebook or Instagram or these things, when people like those, they're getting little bitty bits of dopamine drips in their brain. And it's actually the same mechanism that causes heroin addiction. But it's a slow drip as opposed to that massive rush of the dopamine you get with it when you inject heroin. And they don't know it's happening. And in some of these situations, they're getting several drips of this dopamine every minute, you know, and it's just insidious. And the only way to get that feeling again, a lot of times, is to go back on to social media or go back on to your game and play some more. The problem is, think about when you see a friend of yours walking down a hall you haven't seen in a couple of days, or maybe even longer than that, and you see them and they smile at you and you smile back, your body starts producing these wonderful neurotransmitters, things like oxytocin, especially when you shake hands and you have that physical contact. But it's also producing serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. And you get this great feeling when you see that person. But you get all these other neurostimulants, too, these neurotransmitters being released. And it's like your body is being fully nourished by all of this. When you get on these social media apps, you get on these video games, you're only getting the dopamine. And so it's much like taking a diet soda. You get a sweet taste, your stomach gets full, but there's absolutely no nutritional value in that versus even a regular soda where at least you're getting sugar and some energy and things like that with regular sugar drink. With these technology apps involved here, you're getting that dopamine, and when you walk away from it, you crave that dopamine more because you didn't get that full nutrition like you do with a full meal that makes you say, hey, I'm satiated, I can go hang out for a little while, I can read a book, I can watch TV, I can go for a jog. And then you start slowly, gradually building your hunger up again. In this case, the dopamine is just craving more dopamine. That's the only thing that makes you feel, quote-unquote, normal again. And we have literally millions of American teenagers, adolescents and young adults, and some middle-aged adults that I see in my office in the 40s, that they lose jobs, they have lost any kind of really important relationship, whether it's a spouse or children. And, you know, in some cases, I've had 40-year-old, 45, 46-year-old patients that are back actually living with their parents, sitting in their room playing video games all the time, lost their jobs, and just totally dependent upon the goodness of their family's heart, or they wouldn't have a place to live. And it's all because of that addiction. They crave that dopamine drip.
Now, I know that Facebook really took off when they introduced the like.
Absolutely.
And every time you get a like, that really gives you that surge of dopamine. What
exactly is
it about the technology? Obviously, dopamine is a reward molecule when you receive a reward. What are the rewards of technology that sort of trigger dopamine release?
Well, for example, in video games, it's that exciting jump when, you know, you get that shock when the enemy jumps out and starts shooting at you and you didn't know they were behind that tree or that truck or whatever, you know, it is. It's any kind of stimulant like that. And, you know, that is, you know, ultimately goes back to that dopamine. You know, you get a little endorphin jump, you get the norepinephrine when you get that shock. But the pleasure centers come back in, and the dopamine is ultimately the key neurotransmitter involved in that whole situation.
I've been reading about the gamification features, the things that are rewarding about technology, and talking about like achieving levels or getting social recognition, getting likes, social connection. The balance of challenge, like these gamers really put a lot of effort into making the games challenging but not too challenging, and
correct,
and also novelty. I think if there's predictable rewards or predictable sequences, then people can get disengaged and and lose their interest.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same as our learning principles. You know, if you have a constant, you know, you get three questions right, you get a reward. After a while, you kind of get burnt out on it. It's not as much fun. But when you have one time you get a reward for one act, the next time you get the reward three acts later, and the next one one again, then two, and they just make that variable release of that reward, that makes that so much stronger and harder to break through. And the interesting thing is that our research and the stuff we've seen, if we can get our gamer or our technology-addicted individual to step away for a week, it's amazing how their body starts going back into normal mode. And then we can get them and hopefully teach them to manage a lot better. We find out that if they can isolate one, maybe 2 days a week where they don't do any kind of technology, social media, games like that, and, for example, just use their phone as a phone instead of a gaming device, what we find out is that they actually start putting less importance on those video games and they're actually able to manage it better. But we have to get them to stop for that 7 day process. And I had clients complaining to me and patients complaining to me. So last year I actually took 60 days off. And in fact, I have a staff, so they did all my social media and stuff for me. But I was able to walk away from all of that for 60 days. And it's amazing how little time in comparison that I spend on social media and those types of things now, even with the demands of my job.
Yes. How does that feel to spend less time?
Oh, it's great. And, you know, I get to actually do more things in real life, I take my kids hunting and fishing and camping, and we go outside, and my whole family, we do martial arts. Everybody but my daughter's a black belt now, and it's just amazing how we do that. And we do it as a family, and, you know, my son and daughter are both becoming accomplished musicians because we make them have limits. You know, you can only do this so much. You want to get on your social media, you want to get on your games, you have to pay for it. No, you don't have a job, but you pay for it by doing things that keep you from being on social media. You have to play basketball. You have to join a team sport. You have to do an individual sport like martial arts. You spend time outside, and they acquire credit, so to speak, to be on their computers, to be on their cell phones, to do things like that.
Oh, that's a great idea. Absolutely.
Well,
what do you think the prevalence is? Oh, go ahead.
So I was going to say, we started with our kids when they were real little. They wanted to be on the computer and just play their basic, you know, learning games that we got them. And what we started doing was we would change the password every night, and we would make it a 13 to 18-digit number, and we would give them a set of basic math questions, and they had to answer the questions right and then put the answers in the end in order to get the password to be able to get on their computer.
That's a motivation for learning math, huh?
Absolutely. And neither one of my kids have problems with math to this day because, you know, they realize drill and practice. That's the key learning mod for math.
Very interesting. What is the prevalence of internet gaming disorder or technology addiction? What do you estimate the prevalence of that?
Well, I think it's a lot higher than we want to admit. I see, you know, I mean, just drive around any neighborhood full of kids, and, you know, in our generation, you could tell where everybody was because the bicycles would be there. They'd be playing a baseball game or football game here or there or basketball. Now kids are inside. They're isolating themselves. They're not learning how to make social interactions effectively. They're not engaged. We have some benefits from this. We're having lower and lower teenage pregnancy, lower and lower teenage sexually transmitted infection until they hit that 18 to 20 year old age and they get forced to go out into the workforce because moms and dads say, nope, you're out of high school, you're out of the house. And what happens is now we're having major increases in sexually transmitted infections in that age range. And we're seeing that, you know, it's probably estimated around 30s. Well, I've seen studies as low as 20%. I think it's probably closer to 70 or 75% because this is the standard now for this generation is to be on technology instead of picking up the phone and actually talking to somebody, or instead of actually shaking hands.
Yes, it's another epidemic coming on over us, just like food addiction.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, we have Dr. John Huber with us here, an expert on technology addiction. And this is the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. And we'll please stay tuned, and we'll return back to talking more about technology addiction after this break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. And we have with us today our guest is Dr. John Huber. He's a forensic psychologist who specializes in some very innovative treatments for addiction and also in technology addiction, which we're talking about today. Welcome back, Dr. Huber.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
So when we talk about addiction, I thought maybe I'd love to hear from you talk about what is addiction anyway, and how do you know whether somebody has a technology addiction versus whether they don't? I mean, everybody is using technology. When do you cross the line? What is addiction, and when do you cross the line over into addiction with technology addiction?
Well, it's when you have a behavior that you do, and it tends to overcome your life, and we see patients, they walk in, and one of the things we do is we talk to them about how they function as an individual. Are they losing relationships? Have they lost jobs? Are they, you know, isolating themselves? And they lose activities that used to be their favorite thing, whether it was going to the beach or swimming, and they know, hey, I really need to get up in the morning and go swim, but they get up instead and they pick up the computer and they start playing these games, or they pick up a bottle of alcohol and they start drinking it, or, you know, believe it or not, real sex addiction. People who basically alter their lives because they feel this compelling drive to experience whatever that behavior is that is causing that addiction. And everybody has some of the same models. You know, we talked about that stimulus response model that goes on, kind of Pavlovian. And rationally, they can say this is bad for me, and I know I shouldn't do it, but something triggers them, and they can't fight that rationally. That's basically what I see when my patients come in here, and I get a lot of things from family members. You know, they say, oh, he has an addiction because he is working too hard. Well, it's hard to define. You're a workaholic. We used to talk about that. But there's a lot of gratification and reward for some people working. And one person may think, oh, this is a good thing. Look, he's made $1 million, and he's got everything he could possibly want to buy. But, you know, when I read stories like this and I see entrepreneurs who have spent their, you know, waking hours making more and more money, and they have a nice Lamborghini in their garage, and they've had it for 5 years, and it's got 300 miles on it, so they haven't driven it. You know, you start waiting. Why did you buy that if you're not going to use it? You know, I mean, you can't take the money with you. And we start looking at their functional life. Are they getting their needs met, and are they getting all of their needs met? Go back and look at this Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, are they getting basic food? Are they getting shelter? Are they getting that nurture? And what we find is that the people with those addictions, they are not getting their needs met. And they may come in, and I've had 20-somethings who will spend, you know, 24 hours a day playing their video game addiction and drinking, you know, energy drinks until they actually have a heart attack or some sort of stroke. And their family intervenes and, you know, calls 911 and gets them away from their computers because they wouldn't stop and eat on their own. And but they have all their energy drinks and they can drink those. We've had, you know, 40-somethings who wear Depends so they don't have to get up from their gaming console and go to the bathroom. They can just sit there and play until they just can't stand being in their own filth. And that's an addiction. But, you know, people don't do that because it's fun or good for them. They do it because they can't fight that obsession, and they're compelled to play those games.
So there's a real compulsion to engage in a behavior for the rewards of the behavior, but and maybe some sort of immediate reward, but with delayed negative or consequences, adverse consequences. And so you see people giving up social activities, harm to their health, and they're just compulsively on their computers, and they're not able to stop themselves, even though they know it's harming them.
Oh, yeah. You sit and have a conversation with them. They know what it's doing to them, and they can sit there and tell you that, but they can't walk away from that computer on their own.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think, Dr. Humer, about the negative consequences of a technology addiction. I've heard, people who have these addictions. I saw a video, a YouTube video of a young man in the Philippines who literally would game 24/7 on the computer and not eat, and his poor mother would have to bring him food and spoon feed him while he was playing on the computer. Otherwise, he would not eat, and he would literally game until he collapsed. So this can be very extreme.
It can, and before we had this, I would see, in the 90s, I would see people with some form of OCD. For example, I had a case where the guy locked himself in his bathroom, and the family would bring him food to keep him from, passing out or losing consciousness from not being fed. And it's very disturbing to see that. But the natural consequences of that is that, they would lose consciousness, and then you could get them medical help. But it's not always the safest or best protocol to follow in that situation.
Yeah. I just recently attended a conference, an addictions conference, they had a workshop on gaming addiction. And one of the things I learned was that people with autism spectrum disorder and with ADHD are both have an increased vulnerability to developing an internet gaming disorder or technology addiction. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what are the vulnerabilities do you think that people might have that make them more susceptible to developing a technology addiction?
Well, when you look at ADHD, you see this inability to sustain attention. In the business world, we see people get bored really easy and can't finish their reports and things like that. Well, with these games, with the social media, there's always a new stimulus, and you don't necessarily know what it is. These designers are amazing how they, how they can manipulate people's reactions to different things, and by surprising and changing the trigger, we talked about that variable response mechanism and how often they keep that person who has that vulnerability and that inability to focus and maintain attention, they reward them just enough that they finally found something that they're good at and that they can focus on. So they're actually feeling good about themselves. Hey, I can do this, and I can be successful at this, even though it is causing me to do all these other bad habits. We talk about the negative long-term effects of that addiction, and they rationally know that those are bad for them. But, man, this is a place where a platform where all of a sudden they can excel at and fit in with everybody else. So that makes
Absolutely.
Them really vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah, I think it sounds like one of the vulnerabilities, if you can't lead a joyful life away from the computer that's fulfilling, where you feel fulfilled
yes.
and joyful for whatever reason, and you can get some rewards or some sense of fulfillment or joy or happiness or rewards on a screen that you can't get in your regular life, I would think that would make you more vulnerable to technology addiction. Michael McGee here. Our guest is Dr. John Humer, talking about technology addiction, and we'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Dr. Michael McGee here. We have as our guest Dr. John Humer, a forensic psychologist who also is specialized in addictions treatment, and we're talking about technology addiction. Welcome back, Dr. Humer.
Yes, thank you, Dr. McGee.
So we talked a little bit about the vulnerabilities to technology addiction and a little bit about the prevalence of it. I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about your thoughts about the treatment of technology addiction. Have you gotten very much into treating people for this disorder?
And we have actually, the majority of our treatment patients coming in are people who found out about our ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. and we don't see a lot. I end up assessing a lot of people for the technology addiction, and right now I'm actually, we have a group of about 12 specialists, medical doctors, and other therapists, and we're putting together a treatment protocol specifically for the technology, and hopefully within the next 3 to 6 months we will have research-based protocol and recommendations based on stuff that's already published out there. And it's probably only about 5 or 6% of my case load right now in general compared to all the other addictions that I work with. My guess is, working with adolescents, teenagers, and young adults, that it's going to change dramatically. We're probably going to be in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe 20 years, we'll be looking at probably about a 50-50 split between drug addictions and the technology. So we are working very hard to find research-based protocols. I have not used ketamine-assisted psychotherapy on any of these patients. We've done much more cognitive behavioral interventions with them, trying to find other ways for them to get some of that dopamine reinforcement reward system stimulated. A lot of it has to do with them physically doing activities, physical activities such as martial arts or joining in sports in different ways and taking time, as well as getting them to walk away and go cold turkey for at least a week. And then we start working them back into using technology. Unfortunately for them, most of society now is moving to technology, whether you're taking high school courses, college courses, or going to work. You're going to have to use it. So we have to try and teach them how to manage at the same time, and we're finding the best luck with just cognitive behavioral interventions at this time.
Yeah, that's very important. It's, technology these days, it's almost like food. It's in our day and age, it's hard to survive without it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we used to think, oh, construction, but I work with a lot of people now who do construction, and what do they use? They use all this GPS technology, and even the highly skilled, you know, people who control, like, the blades and stuff like that, when they level the roads, that's all gone computer technology. So they're sitting there on the computer inside their cab on the heavy machinery now. So it's really infiltrated just about every genre that we have as human beings now.
Yeah. So how do you help somebody to re-engage in technology in a non-addictive way?
Well, one of the things we have to do, and I can talk to them myself personally, because I told you earlier in the show that, you know, I took 60 days off of social media, and I can tell them that, you know, it kind of puts a real perspective on it when you get back to actually going out, meeting, greeting, shaking hands, interacting with people, interacting with the outside environment, and you realize that you're missing some critical components of life by sitting in that artificial environment on that computer, whether you're playing a game or doing social media. And we try to work with them and actually process some of their activities, have them do some social media with you in the therapeutic setting, and have them go through and describe what they feel like is going on versus what they felt like was going on when they, you know, went out and joined in a basketball game at the local Y, you know, and how they interacted with humans in that situation. And they start self-identifying the benefits, and, you know, it's the basic therapeutic model. I'm not going to give you advice. I'm going to try and lead you into a place where you come up with your own conclusion. And then we just kind of help guide them into that. And, you know, we've been pretty successful so far. I mean, it's I can't say it's anywhere near that 75% or 80% we're having in this other arena, but, you know, the cognitive behavior is kind of empowering because they realize when they make that leap and that epiphany that, wow, this is really a different world if I actually engage in real life instead of spending so much time on a computer. And they are then very good at helping identifying their own triggers And each person has different triggers, and we can sit there and help them manage those. And it's pretty amazing to watch, especially these young people, you know, have their whole lives ahead of them. And, you know, I see people who are engaged in arts and things like that that never would have done it had they not actually been identified either by themselves or a family member that they had a stick.
Yeah, so really, I mean, if you take away the addiction, you have to put something more fulfilling in its place. Is
absolutely
part of the cognitive behavioral approach that you're using, right?
Correctly. And, you know, and it's replacing an addictive behavior. It's kind of, what do they call it, the FreeNAC principle in behavior modification. You replace it with something that is already there but is more fulfilling, actually, than the behavior that they're trying to engage in that's destructive, and they learn to utilize it and prefer that over the destructive behavior.
Yeah. A lot of our guests, a lot of our audience will not know what cognitive behavioral therapy means. When you do cognitive behavioral therapy, or what they call CBT for addiction, what are the components of that? Help our audience to understand, what is CBT?
Well, if we look at the cognitive component, we're talking about doing things to change how you think about your life, about behaviors. Some people go as far as talking about metacognition, where you are thinking about how you think, and you change that. For example, reframing a situation, using different types of language. Albert Ellis talked about using absolute language. You know, you never should use the word never. You should never use the word should. You shouldn't use these absolute terminology, because you start believing that there's no other choice for you. And you should use things like, I'm choosing to do this behavior, instead of I have to do this. Well, I want to do this is different. And now you have control over it. And it's difficult, because by the time you get into that addiction state, you're using those absolute terms. And it's part of who you have become as a thinking being. Your algorithms to looking at life are using absolutes. And there's very little in this world that's absolute. I mean, we know death is absolute. You know, we used to say taxes, but we see all these people evading taxes now, so I don't know if we can say that anymore. But it is very hard to identify these things yourself. And so that's where a therapist can really step in and work with you in your language, and using subtle changes in word forms. And when you do that, it can have profound effects on how you act on your environment, but also how you look at the world. You know, it can change your centers, what we call your locus of control. If I feel like the whole world acts on me, and all I can do is suffer this external world and how they, you know, affect my life, and I have no control over it, it becomes a very despondent, depressed kind of life. I feel like I have no control. But if I turn that around and reframe it so that, hey, I have control in how I react to what happens to me, now I start becoming empowered, and I can actually do things to increase and improve the quality of life that I have. So that's the first kind of cognitive thing. And behaviorally, what I start doing with them is trying to create some sort of, sometimes it's artificial, sometimes it's natural, a reinforcement system so that we can change their behaviors. And ultimately, those behaviors actually help that cognitive change along. They benefit each other, that cognitive behavior thing. You know, they feed back on each other in a very positive way.
Yeah, so behavior affects cognition, cognition affects behavior. We're talking with Dr. John Huber about the treatment of technology addiction and cognitive behavioral treatment for that. And we'll return right after this break to talk more about cognitive behavioral therapy. This is Dr. Mike at the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show, and hang on to after and return right after this break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, your host, and we have with us today Dr. John Huber, who is, and we're talking about technology addiction. Dr. Huber treats technology addiction as well as other addictions. And we've been talking about the cognitive behavioral therapy for technology addiction. And Dr. Huber, you were talking about the cognitive aspects or the thinking aspects, and you were just getting into talking about changing the behavioral aspects of treatment for technology addiction. I'm wondering if you could pick up and tell us more about the behavioral aspect of treating technology addiction.
Definitely, definitely. What we really like about the behavioral side of it is the ability to actually measure progress, because we sit down and we get baseline data on behaviors, on the target behaviors, you know, what the client is doing or not doing, and we count and measure that. It's really a good modality. You know, we have no problems with our insurance companies reimbursing us for this treatment because we can show them the data, and that's one of the benefits of using it with the cognitive side of it, because we can, you know, the patient can tell us all day that they're thinking differently, but when we actually can count and measure behavioral changes in their life. So we start with a baseline, and we know that just by observing their own data, their own behavior, they're going to change it. So it usually doesn't present itself quite as bad as the reality of it is. And sometimes we'll have other family members collect data with them. Let's say we just measure how many hours a day that they are on technology. And we can do that. There are apps you can put on your cell phone. There's apps you can put on your computer to measure all that. And once we get that baseline data, then we look at strategies and with the individual. And we look at reinforcers outside of the technology and try to find activities and reinforcers that are strong enough to compete with or maybe overcome completely the reinforcement they're getting through the technology. Then we write up a treatment plan of how to place that into their life and how to give themselves a reward system and sometimes a punishment system. Consequences can be rewards and punishments. And then, you know, we can either remove a stimuli or give a stimuli. So it can be either negative and positive in that sense. And we get them to build this plan with us. So the patients take ownership of this plan. And if they come back later and say, oh, that's not fair, I had to do this, this, and this, well, we can sit down and discuss with the fact that, you know, it's not fair or not fair. They helped us come up with this, and we can change it. And we can change that to make it work more effectively with the patient. They tend to participate more thoroughly with it. And we continue to monitor that data, and we have them give us those online programs, and we can download, look at how much time they're spending, if they continue to spend more time. Sometimes we do an intervention, and the time on the Internet goes up. The time on technology goes up. So we learn something about them. We learn that, you know, that reinforcement is actually not a reinforcer at all, and it actually reinforces the negative behavior we're trying to stop. So that gives us a lot of power and control, and it works off not just Pavlovian, you know, stimulus response, but that ability to actually learn where they can actually identify the stimulus themselves and then act on that. So it becomes more Skinnerian-type behavior management, you know, where they can learn that if I affect this lever, the door's going to open and I can get out of this cage. So they get empowered. And then we go back and we continually work on that cognitive restructuring, and all of a sudden our patients tend to, you know, take control of their lives, and they may have felt like they were a failure everywhere else, and then except for this addiction seems to have taken over. Now they get control of that addiction and they get empowered. They can change anything in their life. And a lot of them, we go back and basically reteach these behavioral interventions in a way that they can then start goal setting in their life, whether they want to go back to college to get a degree, and we can spell out the steps they need to take, and they gain control of their lives. It's pretty empowering.
Beautiful. So positive, more realistic thinking, more affirming thinking, more flexible thinking, combined with more positive, rewarding behaviors that produce more a more natural and rewarding lifestyle that leaves you feeling better off than you did before in the addiction. Is that a good summary?
Oh, that is, yeah. You put it in plain English. Thank you.
Great. Okay. And I'm interested in your thoughts about. I know that the current evolution of our field. I'm an addiction psychiatrist myself, and I combine a lot of what you're talking about with the use of mindfulness. And I recently, I just got back from a conference that I was a speaker at in Florida, and I had the pleasure of hearing a speaker there talk about mindfulness and the impact of mindfulness on the brain. Dr. Brewer, Jetson Brewer, and,
yeah.
And he's doing some brain scanning and showing that when you have a decrease in that, when you're very mindful, when you're in flow and just very present with your experience, that when those cravings come up, or that desire, for example, to use technology, that there's a delinking of desire from the compulsion to act on the desire that's stimulated by a reduction in posterior cingulate activity. It's a small node more toward the rear, in the middle of the brain, but more toward the rear, right?
Yeah.
In the center of the brain. And when you get a reduction in posterior cingulate cortex activity, there's a delinking between the desire, for example, to play an internet game, and then the compulsion to do so. And people are left with an open, mindful, kind of curious, receptive, freeing response to their experience of their desires that reduces compulsion. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Brewer's research or you've heard anything about the use of mindfulness.
I've read some about it, and I know personally from taking the 60 days off myself that is exactly what's happening. Like all of a sudden, it's just not that important. I don't have to go and get on that social media app. My experience, I am dealing with many more people with, chemical addictions at this point. And what I find is I get that 60-year-old who's been drinking since they were 12 or 13 years old, and their mindset's kind of stuck back in that 12 or 13-year-old kind of situation. So I have to present that mindfulness in a different format. If I talk about mindfulness and being self-aware, and they just don't really get that higher cognitive introspection. And what I'm finding is I'm having better luck with more of our millennials and the younger generations. I think it's part of their language. They're more used to hearing that type of stuff. But my older population struggles with it. Not all of them, but a lot of the ones that come into my office do. So I don't always try to frame it as mindfulness. I go back to, it's cognitive restructuring, and try to teach them to do that through that cognitive restructuring and reframing. But that is, I think, an essential part of that, for that cognitive behavioral to work. That mindfulness, I think, has to be there.
Yeah, it seems to be where our field is moving towards, this combination of the integration of mindfulness practices with cognitive behavioral seems to be giving us the best kind of outcomes.
I think so. Yeah.
And now you're adding to that now with ketamine assisted therapy and their psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, which is now developing too, which I think is very, very interesting. We're living in very exciting times when it comes to the treatment of addictions and other mental health disorders.
I think we are. It's pretty amazing, to think about it. I go back and, after teaching at university for so long and then, doing and looking at the history of psychology and where we came from, going all the way back to Aristotle and Plato, and then, all of a sudden you jump forward to, all these other different sciences, physiology with stimulus response, Pavlovian learning, and then you go to, Freud, and you look at this abstract kind of far-fetched id, ego, superego model, and I think they all have a place together, and I think, using the mindfulness, using the cognitive behavioral, using the ketamine, we can actually, or ketamine-like, whether it's psilocybin, I think we can integrate all of these different modalities, and then we add the biological side of it, the medicine, to this. I think we are getting ready to just have an explosion of really beneficial, productive models that are going to change the landscape of addiction.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Huber, for being on our show and for talking to us today about this growing epidemic of technology addiction that we're seeing. And want to really congratulate you on the groundbreaking, pioneering work that you're doing. And again, we will have to have you back on our show to talk about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. That sounds very,
definitely,
very interesting. So thank you very much. This is Dr. Michael McGee. This is the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show, and you've been listening to Dr. John Huber talk to us today about technology addiction. Dr. Huber, how can our listeners learn more about you and the wonderful work that you're doing?
Well, we have a website, and within that website, we've got all the links to all our social media, so we can add to your technology addiction. But be mindful of it. Don't overdo it. We also have links on our website to our podcasts and our TV interviews and YouTube videos and like that. And that website is easiest to go to drpsycho.org. That's drpsycho.org. Or you can use the full title, which is mainstreammentalhealth.org.
Mainstreammentalhealth.org or drpsycho.org. Is that right?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again, Dr. Huber. It's been wonderful having you on our show.
Thank you, Dr. McGee. I appreciate the opportunity.